everyone, and welcome back to the NeuroQol podcast series, the show that explores the use of qualitative research methods in neurosurgery. I'm Dr. Charlie Whiffin, visiting researcher with the NIHR Global Health Research Group on acquired brain and spine injury and associate professor at the University of Derby. With me today is Mr. Michael Bahrami-Hassari, and he's the Patient, Public and Community Involvement Engagement Manager at the NIHR Global Health Research Unit on Global Surgery at the University of Birmingham. A very warm welcome to you to the show, Mike. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Charlie. Glad to be here.
So in a bit of a departure from our main focus on qualitative research, I've invited you today to the show to explore community engagement and involvement, because some people find it difficult to distinguish between the two. I'm quite new to CEI in a global health context, and you've been so generous with your time and your knowledge that I thought it would be beneficial for others to hear from you and your experiences in developing your programme of CEI within the Global Health Unit, and reflect on just some of the similarities and differences between qualitative research and CEI to help others who go after us. So we're going to start off just talking a little bit about yourself and your journey, if that's okay. So tell us a little bit about how you ended up working for the NIHR Global Surgery Unit as the Patient, Public and Community Involvement and Engagement Manager.
Yeah, certainly, Charlie. So I'm actually a microbiologist by training. I worked in the lab for a little over 10 years. I worked in particular on bioactive compounds from these gliding bacteria. And I quite enjoyed that for years. However, I craved human interaction. And so I then trained and became a science teacher. So I taught essentially the equivalent of A-levels in Asia. And I discovered in that career the beauty of teaching science and making science accessible to young people. Around this time, I also worked in a nonprofit as a consultant in developing low-cost science toolkits for rural public school children. That was quite enjoyable. And this opened my eyes to science education, engagement with the public outside the confines of a classroom. So a few years back, I was fortunate enough to take my postgrad degree in science communication at the University of Manchester. Quite enjoyed that. Worked in a few museums, science centers, science fairs. It was quite the departure from the lab, as you can imagine, because you interacted with people. Humans are complicated, as they say, not as predictable as bacteria in a petri dish. But I quite enjoyed that. And then about close to 5 years ago, I was fortunate enough to start a role at a trust in the South Coast, an NHS trust in the South Coast of England, a role as a PPI officer. So PPI stands for Patient and Public Involvement, which the NIHR calls CEI, or Community Engagement and Involvement in Global Health. So that's a bit of a disclaimer. In the UK, it's called the Patient and Public Involvement. In global health programs, it's normally called community engagement and involvement. So I started that role around 4.5 years ago, so about 2019. It was quite enjoyable because there were a lot of transferable skills I learned in my science communication degree that I applied to PPI. So it was about making sure that patients understood the research project, using language that was appropriate to them, and also involving them in research, which I'll talk about later on, which was very similar to people who are familiar in the realm of science communication. It's very similar to what we call citizen science. So PPI is very similar to that, but with a focus on medical research. So I did that, and then 2020 happened. We all know what happened in 2020, and we had to adapt how we interact with patients. And so we did a lot of our meetings and interactions online. We developed engagement activities, which still are running now. So me and my team started this coffee morning where once or twice a month we would invite researchers to talk about their work. And these were researchers in the different levels of development in their work. So they could be, pre-PhD students or postdocs or even, you know, fully fledged researchers talking to our patients about their work. I also did some work with patients and the public. This was in the fall of or autumn of 2020 on specifically on the COVID virus human challenge trial. So where you deliberately infect healthy volunteers with the COVID or the COVID virus, SARS-CoV-2. As you can imagine, at that time, that sounded quite controversial, dangerous. And so we actually sought people's views on that. And we wrote a paper. So that was a PPI paper, which I'm happy to talk about later on. And then finally, towards the end of 2021, I was fortunate enough to be part of a group called CoPower. So CoPower is this multidisciplinary research project funded by the ESRC, the European Society for Social Care Research, that wanted to look at the effect of the pandemic on minority ethnic communities in England and Wales, not just through the lens of health and nutrition, but also through the lens of education, social care, policing. So that was quite nice because I saw how PPI could be used or could easily latch on to different aspects of research. So yeah, so that's how I ended up in PPI. And then in January of 2022, you know, I grew up in a low to middle income country. I saw an opportunity to do PPI or CEI, community engagement and involvement in low to middle income countries. And I grabbed the opportunity. I was fortunate enough to start the role. And it's been a year and a half now, and I'm quite enjoying it.
That's great to hear. It's so interesting to hear your kind of your journey to, because you know we've talked before and you feel so comfortable in this role. It's kind of almost made for you. And hearing, I hadn't heard all of that backstory before about, you know, how you ended up here, but it just seems like it's just been this gradual natural progression to where you are now. And your background in science communication, that's, you know, that's made for this particular role, and working with members of the public and having that kind of lay perspective on the things that, you know, academics do, researchers do. That's a really important part of the research process. So I don't think, you know, we've already started using a bit of terminology. So we've mentioned PPI, patient public involvement. You also mentioned citizen science. The big, obviously, headline is the community engagement and involvement.
Right.
So could you just, lots of people won't be familiar with CEI or any of those, that terminology. So could you tell us a little bit more about what you see CEI to be and why it's important to research, how we've gotten to this place now where it's almost an expectation, isn't it?
So again, as previously mentioned, CEI or community engagement and involvement is the term used by funders in the UK when referring to global health research. So, and then PPI is what's used domestically in the UK. Before I answer what PPI and CEI are, this made me reflect, right? So in the UK, we use the term patient and public involvement, but in global health, we use community engagement and involvement. And I was thinking about this and asked myself, why is there a difference? And I realized because in the West, especially when it comes to decisions pertaining to health, individualism is valued. You know, you have agency when it comes to health choices. Sure, you might ask advice when it comes to, you know, your best course of treatment to your clinician. However, in other societies outside of the West, an individual's agency is more affected by the community they're part of. A lot of it is your decision to get treatment or to not get treatment. A large part of that is affected by the community you're in. And so if you want to do effective CEI, I think it's very important that you know the community you're working with. I mean, I guess it's also true if you're doing PPI in the UK, but especially if you're doing it with a non-Western community, it's very important to understand the culture. So, but what is PPI or CEI? So this is the main question. It's very simple. It's a collaborative way of working with individual stakeholders most likely to be affected by research findings. So normally, when you think of health research, clinical trials, observational studies, you think of patients as the subjects of your research. That's the default. That's quite understandable. However, when you look at patients, carers, and communities through the lens of CEI, they're more than just data points. You see them as ways to improve, stakeholders, partners, ways to improve your research. Let me give you an example just so your listeners have an idea. I tried to think of a neurosurgical example, but if it's not accurate, please, I beg your indulgence. So in low to middle income countries, public transport might not be as robust as the West. And so sometimes some of these communities have to think of creative ways of getting from point A to point B. So for example, in Rwanda, and I saw this personally, there are such things as moto taxis. So you essentially hitch a ride on a stranger's motorcycle with a helmet and you go from point A to point B. And as you can imagine, I was talking to surgeons at the University of Rwanda Hospital. Moto drivers tend to have lots of orthopedic and sometimes even brain injuries. So normally, if it's an orthopedic injury, they will need a lot of rehab. But there are challenges to that, especially if they have to pay for surgery. And so how does CEI work in this context? If you want to conduct a trial, it's very important when you recruit patients that you actually understand what a moto driver who's had an accident experiences. And so before you set up a trial, you want to make sure that, for example, all the patient-facing documents you have, your information sheets and your consent forms, are written in a way that's understandable by people who might not necessarily have a science or medical background. So what do you do? You might want to show these documents to moto drivers who've had an injury. For example, you want to do a qualitative piece where you interview these drivers about the after effects of these injuries outside the hospital, because they probably won't be able to go to work ASAP. So there will be loss of income. That has knock-on effects. Let's say you want to interview them, but that's a very sensitive thing to ask, effects of finances. So what you could do would maybe have, you could have a small, what you call CEI advisory group, where you show your topic guide and tell them, okay, these are what we intend to ask people we're interviewing. Is it sensitive? Is it prudent enough? Are we approaching, are we phrasing the questions in a way that is non-offensive? So that's one example I can think of how CEI works in an actual project.
That's great, thank you. I just wrote down a couple of things that I thought was just important to kind of underline. Sure. Really, and I think it's that focus on working in partnership to improve mm-hmm. your research. It's very easy as researchers to just design the study. But actually, if you are not talking to people who are either your potential participants or the recipients of the research you're doing, you can very easily get distracted or go off on a kind of, bit of a blind alley mm-hmm. or do something which isn't meaningful to the people that you're actually trying to help through your research. Mm-hmm. And then you gave some really good examples of, how people can be involved to help with the research. So you gave an example of making sure your documents are fit for purpose. And that's just that's the 101, isn't it, really?
Oh, yeah, that's pretty basic, yeah.
And it's very easy. And again, it's easy for us to lose sight of what does make sense to mm-hmm. people. And how many times have you rewritten a paragraph because someone says, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And that's really valuable information to know while you're trying to recruit people. So the CEI element is really... it's facilitative of research, but it makes your research strong, or hopefully makes your research stronger. Is that kind of what you found?
Yes. And another thing that CEI does, and if I can give another example, would be CEI is a really good way to check the pulse of the community before committing to lots of resources, not just money, but time, into doing a research project. And the one example I have to give is something that my group, the Global Surgery Unit, did. So one of the biggest challenges, especially in Ghana, is the lack of access to surgeries, particularly hernia surgeries. So Ghana, according to estimates, is the one of the biggest African countries that has the highest demand for hernia surgeries. So it won't kill patients, but their quality of life declines significantly if they're unable to have their hernias repaired. And so one of the projects that is in the works in GSU is this study called TIGER, where we wanted to find out, since Ghana does not have enough surgeons to perform hernia surgeries, can we actually train GPs who are able to perform C-sections, cesarean sections anyway, which is more complicated than hernia surgeries, to actually what we call task shift them to perform hernia surgeries. So before we did that in 2019, a few of my colleagues actually went to Ghana, went to communities, spoke to community leaders, patients, carers, to ask their thoughts about this. And we summarized this in a paper, which hopefully, Charlie, you can link to the show notes. But long story short, what patients told us is that they didn't really care who performed the surgery, a GP or a specialist surgeon, as long as they got the repair. So that was very interesting, right? Now, what makes this really interesting is that we also wanted to find out if this would work in India. So we work in a few sites in India, particularly in the Punjab province. And in September of last year, we did what we call CEI consultation. So we consulted with patients, carers, but also medical students, surgical residents, to ask them, you know, is this a concern? Is this an issue? And if it is, what are your thoughts on task shifting, essentially giving the task from surgeon to GP? And overwhelmingly, they said no. It was not an issue, and they found the task shifting procedure quite unacceptable. So this is a clear case of defining or feeling the pulse of the community before committing to doing a lot, before committing to doing the study. So, yeah.
And that example also shows that you can't assume that something that fits one population of people will immediately transfer into another culture.
CEI is very context specific, and it's very important. Now, lest your listeners, you know, assume that I actually am all in all of these sites. No, I'm actually based in the UK in Birmingham. But the good news is that all our sites, all six countries, have CEI leads who are on the ground. So, you know, I'm not reporting this and saying I actually did this myself. No, I coordinate their work, but they are people who actually do the work on the ground. That's very important, because you can't do CEI remotely. By remotely, I mean directing communities from afar. You need to be on the ground for this to actually work.
Well, there's some pick the kind of nuts and bolts a little bit of CEI. Sure. So talk to us a little bit about how, like, the model that works for you, you know, how you've set up. I know there are things called community advisory boards,
yes,
or like membership, how, like, mm-hmm, operating procedures, those sorts of things. Like, how would somebody, maybe if they wanted to set up some community engagement, sure, involvement, what might that look like?
The best example I can give of how CEI is structured is my experience with my unit, the NIHR Global Surgery Unit. So we follow what we call the hub and spoke model. What does that mean? So we work closely with six different countries. So Rwanda, Nigeria, Mexico, Ghana, Benin, and India. Now, those countries, we have what we call a hub. This is the main institution, usually a government hospital, more often than not associated with the university. That would be like the country headquarters. And in that, you have your director, and one of the members of staff there is the hub CEI lead. Okay. Now, when we conduct our trials, the hubs coordinate the activity within the country. And the smaller centers that also join these trials are what we call the spokes. So they all connect to the hub. So how is our CEI structured? We have CEI leads in all the hubs, and the hubs now, at least the hub CEI lead, then go from one spoke to another to establish smaller CEI groups. For example, in Rwanda, they have about 13 spokes. Each spoke has a CEI group of about 5 people, 1 or 2 members of staff, to 3 or 4 patients and carers. So they're essentially kind of like an advisory board for that spoke. And then some hubs, like, for example, again, the Rwanda or the Benin hub, might have what you call a national CEI steering committee, where they gather all the CEI groups in the spokes, they meet, and then they form a group of maybe 5 or 7 people who are the CEI steering committee that's going to coordinate CEI activity across the whole country, across the whole hub. So that's how we have our CEI structured. But again, depending on your organization, depending on how it's structured, it may change. But that's how it works for us.
And was it always like that? Or did you have to kind of start small and build up? Or did you go straight in for a big advisory group? And
yes. So the challenge with doing CEI is that, at least in my unit, some hubs were more keen to start faster than others. So my predecessor, I think, focused on 1 or 2 hubs that were keen. And the whole idea is if the other hubs see that, oh, this hub is actually flourishing in terms of CEI, it inspires them. But essentially, when I had started a year and a half, I knew that the hubs were at different stages. And so the whole idea here, this is, I guess, another takeaway message, is when you're doing CEI, you want to meet your stakeholders, you want to meet your patients where they are, and don't expect them to come to you. So what I did, I recognized that some hubs were more advanced than others, but I tried to establish a few basic things so that all the hubs were more or less on the same footing. For example, at the start, not every hub had a CEI lead. But as late as maybe 2 months ago, we finally have all our hubs having a CEI lead. So that's, I think that's an accomplishment. Not all hubs have spoke CEI groups. A few of them have. So it's about guiding the hubs, because different hubs, different countries will have different capacities. And so it's understanding that and not implementing how you do one thing in one hub to another. So that's essentially my role. But at least making sure that a few of them don't fall far too back. Yeah.
And do each of the groups themselves have the same way of operating in terms of how often they meet, not compensation or like remuneration for...
Right.
Contributing or incentives, those sorts of things.
Yes, there are differences. For example, how often they meet will all depend on the hubs, what we call terms of reference. So that's one thing I told the hub leads to at least have a very simple document, a terms of reference, that outlines how you're going to run your CEI groups. Often they would meet as needed, but I also tell the hub CEI leads to not wait too long before you meet your group. So you don't want to not meet them for a year straight, because that's how momentum dies. So generally, they meet them as needed, which is, at least in the last few months, quite often, because we have a big CEI project in the works. So that's one. In terms of remuneration, that really depends. So for example, some hubs, especially when they invite community members who, let's say, meet up on a weekday and are supposed to be at work, they pay them cash. Now, the rate or how much you pay your public members, of course, will depend on a lot of things. Where in the hub or where in the country are you located? Is it rural? Is it urban? Cost of living, etc. And we leave that to the staff that's on the ground, because they best know what these rates are. It's very improper if staff from the UK dictates that. So we leave that up to them. But we do tell them the important thing of recognizing the input given by community members. So for example, in Ghana when we did our patient consultations for the Tiger study, the hernia surgery, we didn't pay the patients money, but we did give them after our CEI meeting that surgical mesh that they will be using after their surgery, which cost them, well, it's about $3 US, but you know, to people in Ghana, that's a day's wages. So it really, again, this is where your activity being context dependent is key.
I was reading today one group hadn't given people a cash kind of remuneration. Mm-hmm. They'd given them, in consultation, cooking utensils. Yep. Because actually that was more value than mm-hmm. a cash remuneration. It's just interesting to think what's culturally meaningful with some groups, and what we might assume over in this country as being, you know, the ideal of work, way of working communities, you know, won't always translate. And that's why you were saying it's so important to have somebody on the ground locally leading the CEI initiatives. Mm-hmm. So what do you find the most enjoyable about your role, and what personal challenges do you find the hardest to navigate?
Most enjoyable, I actually enjoy traveling and seeing and learning different cultures. I'm usually in a hub maybe 2 to 3 times a year, which I quite enjoy. I've always been interested in learning about different cultures, but also seeing the similarities of the culture I grew up in. I grew up in Southeast Asia. And, you know, when I go to Africa, I realize that there are actually similarities to the culture. For example, closeness of the family, the importance of family, which probably might not be as important in other, I guess, more Western cultures. So I quite enjoy that. I also enjoy the creativity and thinking of solutions to problems, again, because one way does not work for all. So that's why I work closely with staff on site to determine the best approach to engage with the community. Now, it's not always, you know, butterflies and rainbows. There are challenges. For example, staff time and capacity. So I'm fortunate to be a full-time member of staff who oversees the CEI across 6 hub countries. However, my counterparts are usually clinicians. So they're either nurses or surgeons themselves. So they're not full-time. They might have clinical and even academic duties. Some of them are lecturers. And so it's quite challenging to coordinate things, not just across calendars, but also across time zones. I sometimes have meetings as late as 7 or 8 p.m. if I'm speaking to the Mexico hub, sometimes meetings as early as 7 a.m. if I'm speaking to the India hub. So these are things that you have to be quite flexible with, and I'm happy with that. So that's the one thing. I think another thing, so I quite enjoy learning about culture, but culture can also be quite a challenge because how you see power, for example, is determined by culture. So, for example, if you are meeting a women and men in a CEI meeting, depending on the culture, women might be quite reserved because they're in the presence of men. So that's quite challenging. And again, that's why it's always good to have people on the ground who can advise you. Another thing that's quite challenging, but also an opportunity to think creatively, will be the low literacy rates in our communities. And so it's not just literacy in terms of science literacy or health literacy, but also like literacy, not being able to read or write, and even numeracy. And so the challenge here is thinking of ways to, for example, educate patients on surgical site infections, thinking of ways of optimizing informed consent in a trial. So instead of your usual, you know, 3 or 4 paged information sheet, then, you know, how do you ensure that people who join a trial truly understand what they're getting themselves into if they're unable to read? So that you have to think of creative ways. And in relation to that too, I think the challenge here is that a lot of these countries, especially in Africa and India, speak multiple languages. And some of these languages aren't even spoken by our members of staff. And so they actually need to consult with indigenous speakers. And also another challenge with that is some of these languages don't even have a written form. And I found out about that, you know, immediately when I had started the job. And you could see that as an opportunity a threat, or you could see it also as an opportunity to think creatively. I choose to see it as an opportunity.
It's really fascinating when you start digging into the detail, isn't mm-hmm. it? That you just mentioned about, you know, multiple different languages, you know, how do you translate what may be complex research ideas into something really simple so that people can understand and can interpret what you need from them. Mm-hmm. You know, and like say this basic kind of assumption that you of writing, you know, we all write our information sheets, but actually some languages don't have a written form, like you say. And finding out that for the first time, you know, that's quite disorientating as a researcher, mm-hmm, because you, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you have to find other ways, you know. And you said that you touched on that idea of being creative. We're so entrenched in a linear kind of path in research. Mm-hmm. Actually, this makes us stop and think, you know, and that's a good thing, because it, you know, uses a different part of our brain, mm-hmm. and asks us to think, you know, more creatively about solutions, so that you can include like marginalized groups, for example. Yep. And you touched a little bit on that, and I know certainly in terms of our funder, they're particularly interested in engaging with marginalized groups. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you could touch on, or you've had any particular experience sure. with?
Yes. So one of the big projects that we're working on this year is what we call our surgical site infection Community Prevention Toolkit, or SSI Community Prevention Toolkit. Essentially, it's a library of resources that teach patients about what SSIs are and how to self-manage at home. And a part of this would be developing creative tools that are very visual. So that's the NIHR uses the term visual participatory methods. I think that's what they're really pushing for, especially in global health because of low literacy rates. So what have we done? So we've actually developed a short animated video on SSI awareness. So what are the symptoms of a surgical site infection and how to deal with it at home? We've translated the video into 6 different languages, which is not enough considering, you know, for example, Nigeria has about 120 languages. So that's, you know, that's quite challenging. So we focused on languages, at least of our hubs, that are spoken by the most people. And the whole idea is to eventually develop more materials. So the video was developed in consultation with patients. We asked them, what did they know about SSIs? When they had the surgery, what were the challenges they had at taking care of their wound at home? And with that, we developed a 3.5-minute video. Another resource that the hubs are developing is this thing called Your Surgical Journey. I mean, it's probably going to be translated into multiple languages. But essentially, it's a resource explaining to patients what's going to happen to them when they get operated on, from admission to discharge. Oftentimes, when a patient's about to undergo surgery, that's a life-changing event. It's quite scary, especially if you don't know what's going to be done to you. And so you enter the hospital scared and apprehensive, not knowing what happens, you know, before your surgery, during, and after. And so these are resources written in very simple language that are quite visual, that explain to patients, okay, this is what happens, you know, when you come into the hospital for surgery.
It's so nice to be so responsive in, like, traditionally research takes a lot of time, doesn't it? So mm-hmm. you, by the time you've gotten all your ethics approvals and mm-hmm. your governance and your IRBs, all your ducks in a row, you can finally start recruitment. But what I love about, you know, creative solutions, mm-hmm. co-creating resources, working with communities, is you can actually make those more rapid changes much mm-hmm. more quickly, because, you know, it's not research. lot of it is research informed, but actually when you get to the end product, it's about, well, how do we translate this information? How do we work together to create something which is meaningful to a community? And that's where you see impact, you know, and real impact, making real difference and change to people's lives.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's interesting you mentioned the impact, because impact, depending on who you ask, will be different. So if I'm a funder, or maybe if let's say I'm a university, what we're producing, these patient materials, probably might not be as impactful, because they're probably not going to be published in a high impact journal, right? We might report them in a blog or what. However, from a public health perspective, if you look at the perspective of the patient, if you look at the perspective of the community, if they're aware of what SSIs are, and if somehow you can document that this information that you've given can actually help lower incidences of complications due to SSIs, I think that's a win, you know? It's all about determining what is impact for you. So for me, as a PPI, as a CI professional, if I can get communities engaged, if I can get them talking about this issue, if I can get community health workers active and realizing, oh, we can actually do, you know, we can actually support clinicians, not just in terms of, let's say, vaccination promotion, which is the default, but also like SSI care, for me, that's a win.
Brilliant. Thank you. So let's just change gear just slightly and start thinking about qualitative research.
Yeah.
So as a principle, what you've been talking about with CEI, you know, it's talking with, you know, community groups, working together, getting information from them, maybe co-designing, co-creating. Yeah. That sounds awfully like qualitative research.
Right.
And lots of people do get these two. Mm-hmm. I mean, are they the same? Are they different? What are your? Do you find people are confused about the difference between CEI and qualitative research?
Yes. I've conducted training in the UK in all of the six hubs, and this is probably the bit of like the CEI 101 where people get the most confusion. So, not surprised. So I'm happy to discuss, and hopefully this gives clarity to your listeners. So I think the pitfall is that on the surface, when you look at CEI and qualitative research, you see researchers or maybe CEI professionals talking to patients and communities. And on the surface, they look very similar, right? However, if you look at the methods and if you look at the objective of each, then you'll see the difference. So I think to give clarity, oftentimes when you are in the realm of qualitative research and CEI or PPI, you hear the terms participation, engagement, and involvement. So we in the UK, especially if you're funded by the NIHR, we make a distinction between the three. So if you use the term participation, that means that the community member or patient is joining research. This research could be clinical or qualitative. For example, they join a trial, or if you interview them in a focus group or interview. That's research, right? That's qualitative research. Normally, when a person, public member, carer, patient, joins a research, they participate in research, what you get out of that, okay, is data. And when you collect that data, you usually collect that data through qualitative research methods. So, yeah, interviews, focus groups. You normally interpret the data through different paradigms in qualitative research. So it could be the constructivist way. You could also do, since it's data, you can analyze it. So if you want to do thematic analysis, that's perfectly fine, as long as you write it in your protocol. Okay, so that's pretty clear, participation. When you talk about engagement, that's when, as a researcher or a research team, you share your findings to the public. So, in a sense, they don't really give you anything in return, but they're recipients of information. And that includes if you develop any patient education materials. So when you share those patient education materials, videos, blogs, posters, whatever, that's a form of engagement. It's information from the research team going out to the public. If you speak to the press or you speak at a radio station and you talk to patients in a radio station or give them advice, that's also engagement. Involvement, on the other hand, again, very similar to participation. You speak to patients, you speak to carers. However, number one, what you get from these conversations is not data. That's number one. That's the main difference. It's not data. And because it's not data, you can't really process it or analyze it through your paradigms that I mentioned. So the constructivist, the grounded theory, you don't use that in the conversations that you get from your CEI group. So we don't use the term, for example, focus group when we are referring to CEI. We just say CEI meeting, or we use the term discussion group, or we just say conversations with your CEI group. But we don't use the term focus group or interview, just for clarity's sake, even if on the surface they look similar. So you don't obtain data, you can't use your paradigms, you can't do thematic analysis. But what comes out of CEI? Quite a few things that are important, but it's not data. Number one, you could get what you call a consensus. For example, let's say you have a finite amount of funding to do research. You could talk to stakeholders, doctors, but also even patients, and ask them, we have this finite amount, which of these topics should we focus on? Which is a bigger problem in your community? Quite important, consensus, but not considered qualitative research data. Second, feedback to improve research. Let's go back to the previous example I gave. If you show your patients a recruitment poster or an information sheet, you use certain terminologies that they don't understand, and they say, could you change this word? Could you use a better picture that reflects how the community looks like? That's actually a feedback for improvement. What else? If, for example, you want to find out when is the best time to recruit patients. Let's say you want to recruit patients who have just had a cancer diagnosis to talk about, the financial effects of a cancer surgery in their budget, in their finances. That's quite sensitive. That's a very challenging point in time. You could go to your CEI group, in your discussion group, and ask your patient advisors, your community advisory group, when is the best time to approach these patients? How do we approach them? Is there a certain script we say? That's another thing. And also quite interesting, I mentioned analogies of involvement or community involvement to citizen science. So in citizen science, you normally task to the laypersons aspects of the research that are normally done by the scientists. So for example, non-surgical example, let's say you want to find out the rainfall in different areas of England. You ask maybe people to have rain collectors, and then they just record, they collect data. How can this be done in global health? So if you train a select number of community members to do tasks that are normally done by the research team, this is quite difficult and not always applicable in all instances. That's an example of involvement. In fact, one of the researchers in my unit did something like this. So he wanted to find out the challenges patients in Cape Town, South Africa encounter when it comes to accessing surgical care. He knew that as a physician, as a surgeon, patients might not open up to him. So he actually trained a very interested, very active member of the community who had also had surgery to interview other surgical patients to talk about their challenges. And that's actually an example of involvement, because she's doing something normally done by the research team. However, I just have to say, the people that she interviews are actually participating in research because their conversations will result in data. So I hope I've clarified any misconceptions, and hopefully people come away from this podcast quite informed.
I thought that was super clear. I think one of the key points was language, you know, like how mm-hmm. do we describe? And yes. I think sometimes if you differentiate the language between mm-hmm. CEI and qualitative research, then that gives you a good starting point for the mm-hmm. distinguishing features between the two. So is it possible to use CEI and qualitative methods in the same study? And do you have any examples that you
yes.
can think of?
Yes, I do. It's a project I was part of in my previous role. So if you remember, I said that in the autumn of 2020, the UK wanted to find out what people thought of the SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, human challenge trial. So what would people think if they if healthy volunteers were deliberately infected with the virus? To understand how the virus caused disease. So we actually did qualitative research and PPI at the same time. And we published the PPI we did as two separate papers, which I'll send the links to you, Charlie, so your listeners can read it. So what qualitative research did we do? So we actually did an online survey that was accomplished by 2,400 people to gauge their knowledge of what human challenge trials are. We wanted to also find out their perspectives on taking part and demographic data. That's one. So that's the quantitative part. But we also did virtual focus groups with 57 people. Well, not in one focus group, but we broke those groups down. We wanted to ask their ideas around acceptability of a human challenge trial, but also what were the inclusion and exclusion criteria. We had a specific focus group that was comprised solely of non-Caucasian, so minority ethnic individuals, because the whole issue then was, can minority ethnic community members actually join the human challenge trial and what they thought about it. We talked about what their thoughts were in terms of recruitment and also screening and isolation's effects if they were to stay at the hospital for 3 weeks and the impact it would have on their family life and employment. So that's the qualitative bit of the research paper. But before we even did that, we actually did a lot of CEI or PPI. So what did we do? So we spoke to a group of about 28 public members who weren't part of the research group. So one thing I have to emphasize, people in your CEI or PPI group cannot be part of your qualitative research because that's a clear case of conflict of interest. So we met with a group of 28 people separately to ask the following things. Number one, we showed them the survey that was answered by the 2,000 people to ask about acceptability of the questions. Were the questions worded clearly, sensibly? Was it too long, etc.? And then we also showed them the topic guide or the questions we asked people in our focus groups. We asked if the questions were appropriate or inoffensive. Quite important because we talk a lot about health inequalities and quite sensitive things. We also created, for the sake of the research, an animated video explaining what human challenge trials were. And so, again, because this is a fairly, or at least then was a fairly new topic, or probably not as understood by people, we asked them to comment on the video, everything from visuals to sounds to colors, etc. And then the video was actually embedded onto a website explaining trial. And so we asked members of our PPI or CEI group to comment on the text of the website. So yes, qualitative research and CEI can exist in the same project.
That's super clear. So you mentioned in your reply about publishing your CEI work.
Yes.
So you So you had the two papers. One was the qualitative paper, but you've also published your CEI work. Mm-hmm. Now, you said before about it's not data. So yes. There aren't the same ethical issues that arise in CEI. So tell me about how you might go about publishing CEI work.
Okay. So just to emphasize, I think regardless of what you do, qualitative research and or CEI, you need to consider, or ethical considerations need to be thought of. Meaning, you want to make sure that when you speak to your CEI group in a discussion group, you know, it's conducted in an ethical manner. Same is true in qualitative research. Now, getting ethical approval is another thing. If you're doing qualitative research, you definitely need to get ethical approval. However, in the UK, I have to emphasize in the UK, if you're doing just PPI, you don't need ethical approval. It needs to be ethical, but you don't need ethical approval from your research ethics committee. However, lots of disclaimers here. If you are doing PPI, but intend to publish it, you will need to get ethical approval. So for the example that I mentioned on the human challenge trial, we did PPI, we did CEI, but we also obtained ethical clearance for that. In terms of publishing, so normally, okay, depending on the journal that you publish, but for example, if you were to publish your work in the BMJ, if you were to publish a qualitative piece in the BMJ, you are required to have what you call a CEI or PPI statement. And that statement says, how did you involve patients, carers, and the public in your paper? So in that case, you're publishing your PPI together with your qualitative research. So it's not standalone, right? However, in some cases, like in the case of the human challenge study that we did, there was enough CEI done that it could be published as a paper on its own. And so just like your qualitative research paper, we needed to get ethical clearance and we published it in a specialty CEI / PPI journal. And there are a few PPI or CEI journals, that I can think of. So for example, we have research involvement and engagement. That's kind of like the most popular PPI journal in the UK. We also have a journal called Health Expectations, published by UCL, and also Patients and Patient-Centered Outcomes. Now, these papers, mind you, they don't just solely focus on PPI or CEI. They also focus on qualitative research. But if you are writing a standalone CEI or PPI paper, these journals are probably the ones that are the most receptive to those kinds of papers.
It's interesting. When you first mentioned the idea of publishing CEI work, I felt a little bit uncomfortable about it. But actually, if we're talking about knowledge generation, which is, you know, what we're in the game of, then actually, why wouldn't you publish, especially if you've done really good CEI, because you want to share that learning with other people and showcase how beneficial that CEI has been to the development of a project. And research papers are so constraining, aren't they, that you know, you they might have a very short paragraph on, yes, we did CEI or PPI and this was the change we made, but actually that might hide 6 months of preparatory work underpinning the study. So it is a really good way of, you know, generating more knowledge and understanding around CEI activities. So just in our kind of last kind of closing question, what take home messages have you for CEI and qualitative research?
Right. So few take home messages. Number one, if you're confused about if what you're doing is qualitative research or CEI, just think of what you intend to do. If you intend to treat your patients and publics as subjects of the research and you want to generate data, that's qualitative research. If you see patients and the public as collaborators or partners, and you basically want them to provide feedback to improve the research, if you are doing stuff on shared decision-making and improvements, that's CEI. Can qualitative research and CEI exist in the same project? Yes, it can. But it's quite important that you make the distinction between the two. At the end of the day, the main reason why you wanted to do PPI or CEI is that we want to consult with people whose lives will be affected by our research findings. There's a saying that PPI professionals use. It's nothing without us, about us. Oh, sorry, nothing about us without us. So it's very important that you get their voices in research that could potentially change how they are cared for. That's a very sensible and a democratic reason. But another way of seeing this is, you know, communities, carers, and friends are critical friends, you know, meaning they will point out fundamental mistakes and shortcomings of our projects, but ultimately, you shouldn't be really scared to reach out to communities because, in my experience, patients and carers want us to succeed. For people who are scared or apprehensive of doing CEI, you know, I can give you 6 months of training, but really the best way of doing CEI, of learning CEI, is by doing it. You know, learning by doing, but also, in my opinion, knowing your community, regardless of where your community is. Is it in rural Wales, or is it in urban London, or is it in Kerala in India, or in Ibadan, Nigeria? It's important that you understand the context of your CEI. It's important that you understand the culture, because you want to make sure that what you do is understood by the community, is appreciated by the community, and affects the community that you are serving. Thank you.
Such a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much for today. I have thoroughly enjoyed that conversation.
No worries.
And I'm sure that, you know, the learning from that will help so many more people. So I will make links to your papers that you've mentioned today.
Sure.
And thank you so much for joining us and talking about CEI and qualitative research. And I hope you come back another time and we'll pick it up again. All right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Charlene.